the linguist, and all other members. And welcome to the Cultural Review Committee meeting. Today we've got only one issue on the agenda. It is the briefing by the Legal Department on the 2012 submission. As you know, it is the mandate of this committee that every year in May we issue out the notices to the public that if they need any clause in the constitution to be amended or to be reviewed, and then they submit their written submissions to the committee, of which we're supposed to deal with immediately thereafter. But before we do that, we usually take it to the legal department, and we got the legal advice or legal opinion on those oral submissions, and then the committee will deliberate on them and take it between there whether to amend or not the constitution. So today we've got all the legal minds of the legal department. A couple of faces that I did not know. As a result, I would like the MD and introduce themselves, and then I think they know honorable members, or let me say first from the start, on my immediate right is Pat Jaya, our committee secretary, and the gentleman around here, young man, is Johnny, is the assistant committee secretary, and you've got Mrs. Clara Dikhane, the member from the NCOP. We've got Dr. Lotrich from the National Assembly. And next to her is Mr.
Bill Yeloff.
Again, I forgot what she called the name, from the NA as well. We've got the Honorable Safani Linge from the NCOP, Advocate Kam, and from the NA. And the last at the end, it's Patricia Skambla. She's my PA. On my left-hand side, next to the second person there is our researcher, Maru Kwani, and then we've got our media person Raja just behind you. Yeah, a couple of faces from the legal department that I know, Advocate Manara, Dr. Lewis, Advocate Adikari, Charmaine, and yeah, the rest I don't know. Can introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, members. My name is Advocate Rosa.
Good morning, Chief Advocate Gordon. Good morning, members. I'm Charmaine Funimaza. Good morning, members. I'm Sumer Khan. Good morning, members. I'm Kumele Lingen.
I understand. The researcher has been not introduced to the committee. We've got a researcher now. You know that we didn't have a researcher. We didn't have a content advisor. We've got a researcher. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Advocate Mabukwane Muremukholo.
Can the lady next to him introduce herself as well? And the lady behind?
Good morning, Alistair from Israel.
Stephanie from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Thank you. Now that you know each and every... Oh, my apology, Advocate Gordon. I know I took you as an Advocate Adikar. So my apology, please. Okay, honorable members, I'll now hand over to our legal department. I don't know who's first. Advocate Vanar. See you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning to yourself and the honorable members of the committee. We brought this team of legal advisors that worked on the submissions that were forwarded to our office to advise I am just going to outline the process and give guidance on how we're going to proceed. The opinions members would note that there were two references. There is a reference from our office, and that is not the sequence we will be following at this meeting. We will be following a committee reference, because those were the references we received from the committee section, and we did not want to cause confusion. And for the sake of just following their sequence, and that is the sequence I think we would follow even in terms of giving or dealing with the submissions, focus on committee references rather than the legal services references, which we use for our own administrative purposes. The second issue, Chair, just want to indicate that perhaps due to time constraints and the fact that we had previously forwarded the opinions to the committee section so they could be distributed in advance, we're not going to read the opinion word for word. We are just going to zoom to the submission, what the submitter is proposing. We will then provide an advice on whether or not what the submitter is asking for is catered for in terms of other pieces of legislation, and making it therefore unnecessary or perhaps not desirable to amend the constitution, where perhaps a constitutional amendment consideration is required. We do point out that in our opinions we do not deal with policy matters for particularly where there are no legal issues involved. We leave that to the honorable members to deliberate on. That is in brief, Chair, the sequence that we have adopted, the sequence we're following and the approach we've adopted in dealing with these submissions. We'll thereafter leave it to the committee then to deliberate on the opinions. Over to you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Is there any question, members? None. Okay, thank you. Just before you start, give over to the legal advisors. We've got about 10 apologies. Oh, 11. My co-chairperson, she's out of the country due to strategic missions. Inkosi Advocate Olomisa. And then we've got from the NCOP, Charles Depierre is in appropriations. Chane is in appropriations. Honorable Nube, she's in joint rules this morning. And then we've got Gage Elsa, thank you. and then we've got Mr. Snell is in appropriation as well. Honorable Masuta is in joint rules. And Mr. Tihachwi. And Mr. Kuranov and Ms. Ranto as well, she's in joint rules. So we've got 11 in all. Apologies. And Dr. Lotrit will be moving in and out. She's got a teleconference she has to attend to. I hope we'll be finished before 11. Other members, they say they've booked their flights, but I hope by 11 we'll be done by then, depending on your engagement, members. Is that any waste of time? I'll hand over to our legal advisors. I don't know who's first.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to get quickly into it, the opinion that I'm referring to is the one that was passed out this morning. It's submission one, that's from level card launch now. Mr. Nawe's submission deals with two issues. Firstly, he has an issue that African ID identity is not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, and secondly, his submission deals with the fact that culture is not a local government competency. He does not make any specific suggestions regarding amending the Constitution, but he refers to certain sections which he requests that they be reviewed. These are Chapter 7 of the Constitution dealing with local government, Section 152 that deals with the objects of local government, Section 232 which deals with customary international law, Section 233 which deals with the application of international law, Schedule 4 and Schedule 5 to the Constitution. With regard to his submission regarding African identity, that the Constitution does not specifically refer to African identity, we note that the Constitution seeks to set a new national identity for South Africa and the historical context of the country and the goals and values that the new democracy seeks to embody. It is correct to say that there isn't any direct reference to African identity. With regard to Section 232 and Section 233, which requests be reviewed, these provisions deal specifically with international law. Section 232 deals with customary international law and makes it part of South African law where it's not in conflict with the Constitution. And Section 233 provides for the use of international law by our courts when interpreting local legislation as long as it's not in conflict with the Constitution. Now, these sections are important sections as they incorporate a lot of the courts and our laws to have reference to international law. They in no way curtail the development of an African identity. As we said, the submitter is correct in stating that African identity is not specifically referred to, but the Constitution does protect the rights to culture, and it also acknowledges the rights conferred on people by customary law as legally enforceable to the extent that it is consistent with the Bill of Rights. However, the decision to include a specific reference to African identity is a policy decision which the committee may make. With reference to culture, that culture is not a local government competency, the submitter is of the opinion that this prevents or curtails service delivery and prevents the development of culture at the local level. I note that the Constitution specifically protects the right to culture and allows people to form religious and cultural communities. Further, the Constitution directs that all states, including local governments, have a role to play in developing and respecting rights, including the rights to culture. The fact that culture is not specifically included as a local government competency therefore does not exclude local government from having some role in developing culture. Local governments, in terms of the Constitution, must specifically enforce national and provincial legislation, and they have specific competencies which they can use to play a role in culture. However, if the committee wishes to amend the relevant sections, that is the schedules, to include culture as a local government competency, this is a policy issue. Thank you, Chair.
I would propose that let's go through all the submissions and then the committee will deliberate after all the submissions are made. Are you agreed, members? Welcome, Honourable Bloom. Are you agreed?
Morning, Chair. Thank you very much for the welcome. I agree.
Okay, next submission.
Thank you, Chair Pascal. I'll be going through submission 12-2. At the submission by Mr. Tuma. He proposes CGUMA. In his submission to the committee, he proposes 8 amendments. I'll be going to each one of those individually. The first one, Mr. Tuma. Kuma proposed the amendment of Section 92 of the Constitution by making subtle changes to the actual constitutional provision. On page number 2 of my legal opinion, I will read how Mr. Kuma proposes the section to be amended. Equality means the full enjoyment of all the rights and freedoms by all the people to promote the achievement of equality, legislative and other measures designed to protect and advance persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination, and then certain action must be taken. So I'll be going through these individually. The inclusion by all the people would be tautologous, in my opinion, as the rule of legal interpretation or legislative interpretation means that you have to read the entire section of that specific constitutional provision. And in Section 9.1 of the Constitution, it says everyone is equal before the law, which means that if one then looks at Section 9.2 of that Section 9 of the Constitution, it means that all those rights and freedoms mentioned in Section 2 would then be applicable to all the people, to everyone in South Africa. In relation to the suggested substitution of may and must, this will create then a binding obligation on the government or the state to take specific measures. This would then curtail the government from maybe taking other specific measures like addressing certain issues with that specific person or redress to the court. So by limiting that, you would be then limiting the specific action that a government could or could not take. In my view, the amendment proposed by Mr. Kuma would limit the scope of equality as envisaged by the Constitution. Then the second proposal made by Mr. Kuma is that the amendment to Section 38C of the Constitution, Section 38C, he suggests should be deleted altogether because it promotes, in his opinion, sectoral interest. Section 38 says that the persons who may approach the courts are anyone acting as a member of or in the interest of a group or class of persons. Thus, in my opinion, this would limit the constitutional remedies and redress available to certain groups of persons, particularly, in my opinion, indigenous people or cultural communities, to their intellectual property rights, say, for example. So if they are unable to protect these rights because they are no longer able to approach the court as a group or collective, then they would no longer be able to protect their interests. Mr. Tsuma then asked for clarity on Section 88(2) of the Constitution, which speaks to the amount of term that the president may serve. The section says that a president may not hold office for more than 2 terms. He wants clarity on this. As members may see that this is not really a proposed amendment to the Constitution, but I do provide a brief explanation that it's very clear the president must serve 2 terms. The terms will not be consecutive, or doesn't necessarily have to be consecutive. Mr. Kuma then proposes the deletion of Section 142 of the Constitution. Section 140, he says, because suggestion is based on that South Africa is a unitary state and not a federal state, and therefore it must be deleted. Section 142 deals with the constitution-making powers of the provinces. The constitution was drafted in such a manner that it gave rise to a quasi-federal government. So it's not 100% federal, and it's not 100% unitary either. So there is powers for the provinces in terms of Schedule 4 and Schedule 5 to the Constitution. So by conferring constitutional making powers upon the provinces, the Constitution is not creating sovereign states, but instead it's creating the principle of cooperative governance between national, provincial, and local. So therefore, I disagree with the assertion of Mr. Kuma that it creates a unity state and therefore should be deleted. The next suggestion by Mr. Kuma is the deletion of the words in the preamble to the Constitution, "May God protect our people." This submission is based on the fact that he says South Africa is a secular state and therefore the words should be deleted. In looking at the certification judgment, it is accepted that the Constitution is not a religiously neutral document, and there's specific bias towards religion in the constitutional provisions, specifically the preamble, which speaks to God. So, however, However, in the certification judgment, the Constitutional Court held that the invocation of a deity in this in the situation would be God does not amount to discrimination against non-atheists, and therefore doesn't breach the provisions of equality as set out in Section 9 of the Constitution. I then further say that the submission doesn't propose an amendment or positive amendment to the preamble to the Constitution, which in principle amounts then to a policy decision to be made by a committee. The next suggestion by Mr. Kuma is the decriminalization of the sex trade. I take it he means prostitution in this case. So I then look prostitution is dealt with in two separate pieces of legislation outside of the Constitution, which is the Sexual Offences Act and the Criminal Law Amendment Act. The Sexual Offences Act deals with the sale of carnal intercourse and the committing of acts of indecency, which is criminalized, and then the purchasing of carnal intercourse. As such, the suggestion doesn't propose a particular constitutional amendment and therefore should be it can be addressed through ordinary legislation, which is outside of the purview of this committee. The next suggestion is then the legalization of polyandry. Polyandry then refers in this situation to the ability of a woman to marry more than one husband or to have more than one spouse. Marriage in South Africa is regulated in terms of the Marriage Act and the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act and the Civil Union Act. These three acts then set out the grounds for marriage between persons. Mr. Kuma's suggestion then relates to an amendment of the aforementioned Legislative Act and not actually a constitutional provision, and therefore can be addressed through amendments to the ordinary legislation. The next suggestion by Mr. Kuma is the reduction of the provinces from 9 provinces to 4 provinces. He doesn't provide any reasons for why this should happen, but the provinces and the demarcation of the provinces is governed by Section 103, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, which specifically states that the country will have 9 provinces with specific geographical demarcations, which is set out in Schedule 1A to the Constitution. The reduction of the provinces from 9 to 4 would require a constitutional amendment because the provinces are a political creation which during apartheid was the self-governing British colonies which were then the four specific colonies. The provinces were created with the advent of the constitution. The provinces were created by virtue of historical, demographic, economic and social factors. So these are the considerations in coming up with the 9 provinces. While Mr. Tuma's submission does propose an amendment to the Constitution, it does come, for the purposes of this committee, it comes down to a political decision or a policy matter which would need to be decided on by the committee. The next submission is CRC 12.3, which is a submission by Dr. Broderick from the Ubuntu School of Philosophy.
Whilst honourable members are getting hold of the opinion that Advocate Rona will be talking to, we would just think it is ideal at this stage to indicate to honourable members that what we are doing is to advise on the legalities. In other words, is the merit in the submission. You will note that at the end, whilst we make our case, for instance, to say perhaps there is no merit in the proposal, we do leave it to the committee to still make a policy decision, because we are not, I don't want us to appear to be hamstringing your hands and saying, look, because we're saying this, you don't have to do anything about this submission. I just like we needed to clarify that.
other members?
Yes.
Any point of clarity so far? None. Thank you. Go ahead.
There's submission by then, but Dr. Johan Broderick. Dr. Broderick comes from the Ubuntu School of Philosophy, and in his submission, it's not really clear what he argues for. He basically notes that Chapter 2 of the Constitution deals with Ubuntu, and it would be convenient for students to study the Bill of Rights in order to understand Ubuntu. Now, this submission of Dr. Broderick doesn't propose any amendment to a constitutional provisional import that I know of. And therefore, Dr. Broderick's submission would be better directed at a specific parliamentary portfolio committee to be able to deal with these issues. It's not really clear what he is recommending, or he's not proposing a specific constitutional amendment. The next proposal then would be CRC 12-4, which is the submission by Mr. Cortinati. And that deals, I don't know if I've got the opinion yet. Number four. Yes. Okay, Mr. Cortinati questions why different provinces have different conditions and remuneration for public service officials at the same salary level. Section 197(2) of the Constitution provides that the terms and conditions of the employment of those employed in the public service must be regulated by national legislation. In this regard, the national legislation that is being referred to in the Constitution is the Public Service Act, Proclamation Number 103 of 1994. The Public Service Act says that employers shall be paid the salaries and allowances in accordance with the salary scale and salary level determined by the minister. Then the act goes further in terms of Section 3.5 of the Public Service Act, subject to the Labor Relations Act and any collective agreement. The minister will make determinations regarding any conditions of service employees, general or category of employees, including determinations regarding the salary scale of those employees and salary scales for particular categories of employees and allowances for particular categories of employees. So the salaries, salary scales, and the allowances. As such, the remuneration of public service employees is governed by, not specifically by the Constitution, but rather by the Public Service Act of 1994. While Mr. Cortinati doesn't say that there's a specific constitutional provision that needs to be amended or reviewed, in my opinion, Mr. Cortinati's submission should be directed at an appropriate parliamentary committee like the Portfolio Committee on Labour, perhaps. And I think that's done for now.
Thank you, Advocate Roder. Just want to add to honourable members, just to demonstrate the point that Advocate Roder was making in respect of the amendment for the proposed amendment of Section 38C of the Constitution, where there is a proposal that anyone acting as a member in the interest of a group or class of person should take out that particular provision. I just want to demonstrate the importance of this particular provision. In the Eastern Cape, the Department of Social Development, because they were faced with ghost claims in respect of social development claims, social claims, welfare claims, the government decided to stop, because they wanted to deal with this corruption. So they wanted to stop all payments, sick payments, all disability grants, so that people can be registered from afresh. but this had enormous consequences for the vulnerable group, because those people that depend on social grants, and some of these people did not have people to take to the doctor, because you must now get a doctor to certify that you are indeed deserving to get this grant. And it affected a number of people adversely. And of course, these people would not have the means to challenge the government. One group sought to litigate on behalf, to bring a class action on behalf of all the affected individuals. And whilst that was initially challenged by the department, but I think the Constitutional Court emphasized the importance of Section 38C, because you could see the importance of that clause when destitute people with no means to challenge the most powerful would have been left disadvantaged. So that is why we make the case that the taking away of Section 38C would not be desirable. With respect to the Ubuntu principle, yes, it is not a principle that you would find in the Constitution, but the Constitutional Court in the State versus Makwenyane judgment, which dealt with the issue of corporal punishment, acknowledge the existence of this principle, and we could safely say that it is part and parcel of our constitutional democracy jurisprudence. Thank you, sir. We'll hand over to the next colleague.
Thank you, Chairperson. The submission I'm referring to is submission 5 by J.M. Ramakoteli. It was passed off this morning as well. In the submission, Mr. states that Section 10 of the Constitution, providing for the right to dignity, is silent on the enforcement and protection of the dignity of the majority of people, especially African people. The example he cites in this regard is that of white employers or supervisors driving buckets with no passengers in the front of the bucket, but with black people sitting at the back of the bucket. He says that this practice contradicts the preamble and the founding provision of the Constitution and infringes the rights of dignity, especially that of African people. His view is that the Constitution does not sufficiently protect the right to dignity, and that such a practice of carrying people at the back of a bus should be an offense or a violation of human dignity. On page 3 of the opinion, I state that the right to dignity is already protected in our Constitution, and there's an obligation on the state to ensure that this right is promoted and protected. With regard to the specific issue of carrying persons on the back of vehicles, there is existing legislation. The National Road Traffic Act provides for regulations regarding the carrying of persons on the back of goods vehicles. The relevant sections of the act are, or the relevant sections of the regulations are Regulation 247, 250, and 233. In terms of the regulations, the carrying of a person of on the back of a goods vehicle is prohibited unless the vehicle is enclosed to the correct height requirements and it is made, the enclosure is made of the correct material that prevents a person from falling off, and that when a person is carrying on the goods vehicle, they are not carrying with goods or tools. There must be a partition that separates them from goods or tools. The regulations also state that if the section is violated or is contravened, the person who contravened it may be liable for a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 6 years, or maybe be sentenced to both. There is a further regulation, 250, that says that a person may not be carried for reward in a goods compartment of a motor vehicle on a public road. I acknowledge that the carrying of passengers on the back of goods vehicles raises much safety concern, that if there is an accident, there is no protection for people sitting at the back. Further, we must acknowledge that this usually affects people who fall into vulnerable groups, such as farm workers, casual laborers, and also often children are carried at the back of these vehicles. While the existing law does prohibit this and does provide safety measures, the committee must decide whether this is sufficient and to protect people, and also consider the fact that there may be an infringement of their rights to dignity by them carrying in this manner. Therefore, it is suggested or submitted that the committee may want to liaise with the relevant committee on transport to decide whether the present regulations are sufficient to protect people and also to ensure that their right to dignity is adequately protected.
Next presenter.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'll be speaking to submission CR 12-6. I think on the front page of my opinion, I reference it as 612. The submission I'll be dealing with is one made by Mr. Mtembu, and the overall thrust of what he is submitting to this committee is that the entire South African government landscape should be changed. That's in a nutshell. You'll see on the front page, which is numbered page 2 of my opinion, under paragraph 2, I then set out briefly in summation form what he's saying, and just to run members through that quickly, he's saying that we should replace the unitary state, the unitary state should take away the role of provinces completely. National Council of Provinces should be dropped, we should only have a National Assembly. And while the members in the room who are indeed from the National Assembly may seem to be comfortable, the next point he makes is let's get away over the 400 members of the National Assembly and reduce that to 200. And so he then says, and let's add to that equation, let's take away the system of proportional representation, let's bring in constituency-based electoral system. And then he says, just to add a bit more to that pot, let's not rely on constitutional supremacy, let's add a bit of parliamentary supremacy back to that equation. And and just by the chuckle around the table, I think I can end my submission on that note, but indeed taking the members further, I think he then also goes on into submission and deals with issues of the national anthem. He raises a question about the preamble, Khoi and Sand languages, and then he also makes a submission that falls within Chapter 9 of the Constitution. And then just to take the members through the opinion on how he elaborates further, under paragraph 5 of my opinion on page 3, he will address, for instance, the issue of the preamble and his questions. He raises the issue in the preamble that states, South Africa belongs to all who live in it. And he raises the question, he says, does South Africa really belong to all who live in South Africa? And he says, surely that when we have foreign nationals in our country, South Africa can't belong to them, and surely their country belongs to them. That's essentially what he's saying. But if we look at the Bill of Rights, for instance, we'll see that the Bill of Rights is the cornerstone of our democracy, and the rights in the Constitution will set out the context of what is meant by that everyone. Everyone is qualified under certain sections in the Constitution. I think, in my opinion, I, for instance, draw comparison in paragraph 5.4 to section 19.3 of the Constitution, which is the right to vote. So when we vote in South Africa, it's a right afforded to citizens. So it's not necessarily anybody who finds himself in South Africa who is not a South African citizen and then being able to vote. Contrasted, in my opinion, once again under paragraph 5.4, I make reference to section 23 of the Constitution, which is the labour right. And that right says everyone has the right to fair labour practices. So I think there's substantial basis in the Constitution that gives impetus to what it means when we say South Africa belongs to all Zimbabweans. The rights are indeed qualified in the Bill of Rights, and therefore in paragraph 5.5, my recommendation to this committee is that there's no amendment before the committee that is proposed by Mr. Mthembu. And I state that also because he's just making a comment, but he's not saying to this committee, I would like you to do X, Y, and Z. He's just questioning. And that by itself is not a proposal for a substantial amendment. The second point that Mr. Mthembu raises is the supremacy of the Constitution. Now, I have mentioned under the summary that he's requesting that we bring back a hybrid scenario of parliamentary supremacy and constitutional supremacy. And I think just in our normal brains, we can understand that where we find ourselves in the context of South Africa, we've moved away from parliamentary supremacy because of the legacy of apartheid that we've left behind. I don't think I need to go into much more detail about that. Purely to say that obviously the constitutional supremacy is a concept where we are able to keep all spheres of government in a checks and balance mechanism. Every sphere of government is an independent subject only to the constitution and law, and then similarly a sphere of government has the ability to hold another sphere accountable for whichever action is done in terms of the constitution. In paragraph 6.5, I also bring out the founding provision, section 1c and section 2, which then give impetus to the fact that our constitution is supreme law, and that law and conduct inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid. And so in 6.6, I'm saying that there's technically then no submission before the committee for the purpose of an amendment. Moving to paragraph 7, in my opinion, relates to section 4 of the Constitution. Mr. Mthembu is arguing that the national anthem should be changed. He says the DSM should be dropped. He's saying that doesn't fly, we need to get rid of that part of the anthem, and so please, Committee of Parliament, check our DSM. Now, if we read Section 4, we'll see that the national anthem is determined by the President by proclamation. So I'm not dealing with the substantive effects of his request, because there's no basis for this committee to even deal with the words, the lyrics of the anthem. That's for the President to determine. And so I'm saying, in my opinion, that should Mr. Mthembu like to have his submission taken on a more serious note, he should correctly address that to the President of the Republic and not to this committee. Paragraph 8 of my opinion speaks to Section 6.1 and 6.2 of the Constitution, where Mr. Mthembu states that he would like the Khoi and San languages introduced into the Constitution. Now, Section 6.2 of the Constitution speaks about historically diminished indigenous languages of our people. Section 6.2 of the Constitution does not specifically use the words Khoi and San languages, but I think that we, when we're speaking of indigenous languages with historically diminished use and status, it is indirectly perceived that Khoi and San will fit into that category. More particularly, we have a bill before Parliament, the Use of Languages Bill, 23-211. I believe the bill is with the NCOP at the moment. And what that bill does in clause 4.3 of the bill is to reiterate section 6.2 of the Constitution. And that bill says that, once again, that it is now through national government, national public enterprises, who are going to now take into account the fact of furthering the historically diminished indigenous languages. So what Mr. Mthembu is saying to this committee is please include that in the Constitution. My advice to this committee is that we would not have to do that as this committee, because the bill before Parliament would be addressing that issue that Mr. Mthembu speaks to. Paragraph 9 of my opinion deals with property, section 25. And what Mr. Mthembu is saying is let's take land away from people and not pay them for it. We need to look at a land redistribution, and let's just take it and think that where it has to be irrespective of compensation. Now, the Section 25 property right in the Bill of Rights is a negative right, first and foremost. But before I get into Section 25 sub 1, 25 sub 2 requires that when an expropriation takes place, you would need it to be A, for a public purpose, and I'm reading now at the bottom of page 5 of my opinion, saying sub 2, we say that it's for a public purpose and subject to compensation. So compensation in terms of the Constitution is a requirement. So when the submitter says, let's take away land, but let's not compensate because it's not urgent and we need to address this issue, what he's actually saying to this committee is, let's all breach Section 25.1. We'll see, still saying at the bottom of page 5, sub 1 says, no one may be deprived of property. And so we'll note that Section 25 is not a positive right. It doesn't say, I have the right to property. It says, I have to have something before you take it away from me. And if you take it away from me, there are certain constitutional grounds and lawful compliance that you need to meet in order for that to be constitutional. Now, if we take away, or if we effect an appropriation by not complying with 25.2b, what we're actually saying is we're depriving people. And that's the legal position around property. Obviously, if there is a need in South Africa to be looking at expropriation without compensation, then that would require a constitutional amendment, but a substantial policy shift. I'm also not ignorant and closed and in living in a bubble to appreciate that Section 25 is a deeply political issue in South Africa. And so it's not my position to sit before this committee this morning giving advice on policy, but merely to advise the committee that the proposal that is made by Mr. Mthembu does not meet constitutional compliance. Moving on to paragraph 10, at the bottom of page 6, and I just need to make a note. In the actual submission by Mr. Mthembu, he sets out his submission according to sections of the Constitution. So if members are cross-referencing, what I've done in paragraph 10 of my opinion, I refer to both section 40 and 42 of Mr. Mthembu's submission. He has it under different paragraphs. I've included it in one paragraph because it's the same thought that flows through. So instead of having a disjointed approach, I've then included both section 40 and 42 under my paragraph 10 of the opinion. That's just for ease of referencing. Now, what he says in respect of 40 sub 1 and section 42 sub 1 is that provinces are a financial burden to South Africa. Let's do away with provincial legislatures and then let's do away with the National Council of Provinces. That's what he's saying. And so I don't even have to go into a further argument on that point. You know, just to state that if this committee does indeed decide, and I'm sure that perhaps the chairperson, I'm not sure where his bias would lay on removing the NCOP, but and perhaps maybe we should get that vote in before the joint chairperson arrives. But just on a more serious note, that if that is the view of this committee, that the National Council of Provinces serves no function, that it is indeed overburdening the state, that's a decision for this committee. That's purely not a legal matter that I can advise. But just pointing out that what Mr. Mthembu is saying is it's a financial burden and let's do away with it. That's his position before this committee. And then to now move from the honourable members of the NCOP. And now we get to the members of the National Assembly, saying we have too many. Let's reduce from 400 members of the National Assembly to 200. He's saying that once again, the financial burden on the state, we can do so much more with 200 members instead of 400. And once again, Chair, I don't think there's any more law that I can add to that. Safe to say that where we find ourselves, that's the system that comes from... That's derived in terms of the Electoral Act, which speaks to the Constitution. Our system of electoral system comes from proportional representation. The Constitutional Court has looked at that in the certification judgment, find no problem with it. The only caveat that the Constitutional Court did issue at the time was to say if you indulge in floor crossing, and that's an issue that we've all forgotten about, but I just want to add that into the pot, that if we had an issue of floor crossing, that's where we leave our voters behind. That's where we run the proverbial gauntlet. where we say we are now holders of public office. We just regard the people that have voted for us and put us there, and we do our own thing. And that's the only caveat that the court had issued on the proportional representation issue. Coming to the last point by Mr. Mtembu, he's saying that there should be an institution included in Chapter 9 of the Constitution that deals with press media. Now, we know that Section 192 of the Constitution makes provision for broadcasting, and we know that there's no inclusion in Chapter 9 for print media. And print media has always been a bit more of the contentious side of media. And Mr. Mtembu argues, and he refers in his submission to this for reference in my paragraph 12.4, he's speaking of a Press Freedom Commission report of March 2012. And he's saying that should basically be the foundation to include an institution looking at regulating print media under Chapter 9 of the Constitution. Having read that report, Chairperson, I can advise the committee this morning that what that report recommends is a system of co-regulation. He's saying that public should be involved, there should be different roles. One of the mental aspects that comes out of that report is that we don't want government involved, we don't want state involved in this. Now, when you're looking at Chapter 9 of the Constitution, Section 181 sub 5 particularly holds the Chapter 9 institutions accountable to the National Assembly. So if you're making a recommendation to say, look, we don't want government involved in this, then we cannot be speaking of a Chapter 9, because how can we have no government involved? You get all the benefits of a constitutional empowered institution, but yet you don't want to come and account to the very body that's giving you all these great powers. So in that respect, in my paragraph 12.6, where it was 12.7, I'm saying to this committee that there would be no basis for the submission for an inclusion in Chapter 9. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. We'll move straight to Advocate Rhoda.
Thank you, members. The submission I'll be speaking to is CRC 12-7, the submission by Mr. Brian Carr. From the submission provided by Mr. Carr, he is concerned with the failure by the local authorities to respond to any written request by himself and other members of the municipality to requests, concerns, and queries of transgressions. He further submits that he's not aware of any specific constitutional provision that would govern the failure of local authorities to respond to these requests, concerns, and queries, but that it is his right in terms of the Constitution to receive a reply within a given period. Having read his submission, it's not clear to which provision Mr. Carr is relying on to request information, or whether it's just simply lodging complaints to the local authority. In viewing his submission, it appears that he was or is a local councillor in the Durban area. Mr. Carr also then requests that the committee considers implementing or affording more rights to ensure that local authorities comply. I'm not sure comply with legislation or with the requests or queries and concerns. And the municipality in this regard is quite a cruiser municipality. Section 32 of the Constitution provides that everyone has the right to information held by the state. If it's another person, any information that is held by another person, and is required to exercise the protection of rights. Then important for this particular issue is the national legislation must be enacted to give effect to this right. The national legislation in this regard would be the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Section 9E of FIRE sets out the objectives and basically states that it's to promote transparency, accountability, and effective governance of all public and private bodies, including but not limited to the empowering and educating everyone to understand their rights, to understand the functions and operations of public bodies, and to effectively scrutinize and participate in decision making of the public bodies that affect their rights. So it's a very important right, the information there. In terms of the definition section, a public body would then also would the Kwadakusa municipality would then fall within the definition of a public body. Then from the submission, the public body, as I said, would be the municipality. Section 29 about the Promotion of Access to Information Act and not to a specific constitutional provision. Therefore, his submission doesn't propose an amendment to a constitutional provision, but rather should be directed towards a particular parliamentary committee, in this regard, probably justice, who would then deal with the Promotion of Access to Information Act. It's not a constitutional recommendation. Thank you. That is correct. I know that there are specific committees who have petitions legislation. I'm not sure if KwaZulu-Natal is one of them. Do they have one? And Karting. Yes.
Okay. Can you go to the next opposition? Advocate Carter.
Thank you, Chair. The next opinion or the submission that I'll be speaking to is on my front page, reference committee reference A12. It's a submission to this committee by the Honourable Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. The letter, I think, had given good opportunity for an amendment, but yet there's no amendment in the letter. And that was a bit limiting in the sense that we couldn't then reply in respect of a legal opinion. Because what the Honourable Chairperson does state is he says, in his letter to this committee, he says, I intend to submit to the Constitutional Review Committee proposed amendments to the following provision. And then he sets out the provision of the Constitution, Section 73(4), that limits the introduction of bills to members and committees of the National Council of Provinces. And what the chairperson of the NCOP is saying, he's saying, we would like to look at extending a competence to possibly ministers to introduce bills, Section 76 bills in the NCOP. Now, that's an intention, but the submission does not give us the amendment. He says, I intend to submit. So, Chair, my opinion then says there's no substantive matter for this committee to consider. It's merely an intention. So even though I do not say this in my opinion, one way of my recommendation to the committee would be to perhaps write to the Honourable Chairperson and say, would you then consider giving a substantive amendment that may be considered? I cannot advise at this point in time because of the fact I don't know what that amendment will entail. And that's where the view stands on that matter. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. We'll discuss that in the committee. The next submission.
Thank you, Chairperson. The submission that I'm going to deal with is submission 9 by Dina Bogatsu. The submitter raises two issues. Firstly, she has a complaint against the leadership in the community as there is unfair treatment of people with disabilities. She states that there's a particular school called Pera School, which children with disabilities are unable to complete their schooling, and as a result, they're not able to find proper employment and have to take low-paying jobs, and also they have to rely on the state to help them. She requests that the committee engage with the municipalities, the hospital, ESCOM, Telcom, and the post office to employ people with disabilities. She also has a second complaint where she alleges that a company hired her son and dismissed him because he did not have a matric certificate. With regard to the first issue, the submission of unfair treatment of people with disabilities, there is no request for a constitutional amendment. However, the committee may consider referring the submission to the relevant committee on women, children, and people with disabilities or on basic education, there may be more assistance to the submitter. Secondly, with regard to the labor dispute, then again, there is no request for an amendment to the Constitution. The current law provides sufficient mechanisms which the submitter could use to get redress, and we therefore advise that the submitter may want to seek the help of an attorney, or if he's unable to afford one, she could contact the legal aid of South Africa, a campus law clinic, or the nearest legal resource center. So that is our advice, and the committee may want to write a letter to advising of that accordingly.
Okay, can we have the next submission?
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. I am dealing with the opinion CR 1210. It's by Mr. John Price, and it relates to the appointment and term of the President. The submission in a nutshell, Mr. Price, is of the opinion that our Constitution needs to be amended with regard to the appointment of the President. As he says, our current system places, or in his opinion, our current system places too much power and influence in the President, and he links that to the proportional representation system we currently have. Mr. Price then, in proposing an amendment, refers to the Switzerland model, and he says that Switzerland is run by a council of 7 members, and he proposes that a similar system be incorporated in our constitution, where one of those 7 members then acts as a president for 12 months, and the job rotates every 12 months, and nobody may hold the position of the president for longer than one term during the life of a parliament. Mr. Price himself actually acknowledges that the presidential appointment system we currently have is a generally acknowledged one internationally. So he acknowledges on the one hand that there's nothing wrong with the system, and then criticizes the system and says it must be changed. I went to look at the proportional representation that he then links. Proportional representation in our system is linked to the electoral system, because the president is appointed in terms of the Constitution by the National Assembly. So in doing so, you have the checks and balances where the legislature and the executive balance each other out. But the Constitutional Court has also said, as my colleagues have indicated, that there's nothing wrong with the proportional representation system we currently have, or the electoral system, as Mr. Price himself has acknowledged, that is a generally accepted one. The courts have indicated that there are more than one system that can be opted for, both electoral and proportional, and therefore more than one of the academics have also acknowledged that it's a political issue. It's a choice that ultimately has to be decided by Parliament, as whether this requires a policy amendment, whether a new system needs to be incorporated, but ultimately alternative models are present, but our current one is an acknowledged one. Therefore, it's not a legal question that needs to be considered by the committee chairperson, but a policy one. Thank you.
Move to the next submission.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. I'm addressing you on Committee Reference 1211. The submission that I'm dealing with has been made by the Institute for Accountability in Southern Africa. I'm going to refer them as IFASA, just to make it quicker when I talk. They've made 3 proposals in their submission. The first proposal is for the establishment of a new Chapter 9 institution, the EAGLE, or anti-corruption. The second one is in relation to proportional representation, and the third proposal is in relation to the membership of the Judicial Service Commission. I will start with the Chapter 9 anti-corruption commission or body. If I can basis the submission on the judgment of Dennis de Villiers, the President of South Africa, and others. Now, in this matter, the Constitutional Court declared Chapter 6A of the South African Police Services Act inconsistent with the Constitution, in that it failed to establish an adequate degree of independence for the Directorate of Priority Crime Investigation. There's currently a bill that is before Parliament, the African Police Services Amendment Bill, and IFAZA also criticizes this bill and says, you are again trying to establish this body with national legislation and it's not sufficiently independent. The court in Glenister, however, I need to point out, indicated that it did not say that our constitution does not require necessarily the establishment of a corruption fighting unit, but the constitution as a whole imposes this duty. So the constitutional court acknowledges that there is a duty to have a unit such as this. There's also international agreements that bind us to have something such as this. But, very importantly, the court emphasized that the form and structure of the entity in question lies within the reasonable power of the state, provided only that whatever form and structure is chosen in the end do indeed endow the entity in its operation with sufficient independence. Now, in fact, I also referred to the minority judgment because I thought they put it so much in such well written words. It is the power of Parliament to establish an anti-corruption unit and to locate it within the SAPS. The Constitution does not prescribe to Parliament where to locate the anti-corruption unit. It leaves it up to the executive, which initiates legislation, and ultimately to Parliament to make a policy choice. And I think therein lies your answer. Whether this should be a Chapter 9 institution or whether it should be a unit created by national legislation is a matter of policy. That is where I'm going to leave that answer, because this is not something that has legal implications. It is absolutely a matter of policy. The second aspect is that of proportional representation. And if I can refer this committee to the report, Sansel Slabbert Commission of Inquiry report, the Electoral Task Team's report of 2003. And it says this proportional system was only actually as we were in a transition period, and we now need to look at constituency rather than proportion. But if this committee still wants to stick to this proportion, then let us at least delete Section 47(3)(c) of the Constitution. Now, that specific section provides that a person loses membership in the National Assembly if the person ceases to be a member of the party that nominated him or her. So those are the aspects that he's requesting in this regard. Now, again, it is not a matter of law. The I think two or three have sort of tried to make notes which deals with the same issue. But I've dealt with proportional representation. It's absolutely a matter of policy. The one thing that I did have a look at that maybe takes the matter one step further was, should this committee decide to accept this proposal and change the system, is this something that can be done by way of an amendment, or would a referendum be required? And in this regard, I've had a look at the United Democratic Movement, which is the President of the Republic of South Africa case, where the court actually stated that where something radically, fundamentally restructures the constitution, that's not an amendment. But it looked at electoral systems, and it said that as long as it does not affect the founding provision of a multi-party system of democratic government, the choice is open, however you wish to have your electoral system. Just on another matter, should the committee decide, because remember, as I've said, it's a policy decision, should the committee decide that to recommend that the deletion of Section 47(3)(c), which deals with the membership of the National Assembly, that section was brought in to bring some parity between the province, local government, and national government. So if that decision is made, it will also have an effect, and we'll also have to look at how it is set up in the provincial government and the local government. The last aspect that IFAZA addresses is the Judicial Services Commission. I've quoted a few of the aspects that they indicate, and I'm not going to repeat it. They're quite scathing of the JSC. And in this regard, I had a look at the certification of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa judgment, the first certification judgment,
where the court actually considered the composition of the JSC. And the court held that the composition of the JSC is a political choice made by the Constitutional Assembly. Therefore, it is an absolute policy decision. Just maybe as some support for how it is at the moment, is that it is not a new phenomenon to involve parliamentarians or the executive in the appointment process and the decision to amend your composition. It's simply a policy decision that will be taken by the Houses. But it is not something new. It is not something that we are unique in the world. Thank you.
Okay, to the next submission.
Greetings again to all the members. My submission is the one for Constitutional Review 12 of 12, which is coming from the Inkatha Freedom Party. The submission deals with quite a number of issues. If I can just briefly take you through them. Number one, it requests that the House of Traditional Leaders should be included as one of the intergovernmental structures. The second issue is that they request that the local municipalities should be established in traditional communities and actually be the same competency and power be given to traditional councils. The third issue is that they request that traditional courts should actually be included as one of the courts of law. And then the fourth one, it deals with the electoral system as well as managing elections within traditional communities, where they are suggesting that there should be an in-consultation before elections can take place between the Independent Electoral Commission together with the traditional council. And then the last one is that they request that Section 12 should not be speaking to the traditional leadership institution as recognized, but it should be guaranteed, and that houses of traditional leaders should be made departments under parliament or provincial legislatures. So I'll just briefly take you through the opinion and our thinking as to what then we suggest or advice to the committee. With the first one, which deals with the intergovernmental structure, in terms of the constitution, that is section 41(2), which speaks to what can be done with regards to intergovernmental structures. And section 41(2) of the constitution actually does not establish or determine exactly what those structures should be, but it is giving it out to legislation, which is the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act, which gives effect to what then the provisions of Section 41(2) were empowering Parliament to do. And in terms of Chapter 2 of the IGRS, there are a few established intergovernmental structures, which includes, if you look at number 6 of my opinion, it's the President's Coordinating Council, National Intergovernmental Forums, Provincial and Other Intergovernmental Forums, Premier's Intergovernmental Forums, Interprovincial Forums, Intermunicipality Forums, District Intergovernmental Forums. However, it is very clear if you look at that chapter of the IGR that there is no specific mention of the traditional leadership being included into those structures. But looking further, it says that the chairpersons of those forums, they may extend invites and indicate as to whomever they want to be involved or they want to invite in those forums as part of the forum itself. But clearly, in our opinion, perhaps because this suggestion has come up a number of times from the previous other submissions, that maybe the current status quo is not satisfactory with regards to cover the traditional leaders. But then again, if you look at Section 5 of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, it also permits the creation of partnerships between the district and local municipalities and kingship and queenship, which is also still another way of promoting intergovernmental relations. However, as I said clearly, it is a policy decision that perhaps the committee may consider or refer to the relevant committee that may look at this, but there is no specific requirement for an amendment of the Constitution because, as I said, Section 41(2) is broad enough to just generally state what is required in terms of what can be ICR structures. And that takes me to the second issue, where they are requesting that Chapter 7 of the Constitution should be re-looked at, where there should be a disestablishment of local municipalities where there are traditional communities. And they suggest that when they de-establish those local municipalities, then traditional councils should actually take over those competences. In terms of the Constitution, we looked at the specific sections, which is 155, and 155 actually sets out what are the municipalities that should be there. And I briefly define what a local municipality is. They suggest here that a local municipality should be changed in traditional communities to a traditional council. Basically, a local municipality is a municipality which shares its competency with a district municipality where there is one. Again, thus, what I'm basically stating in my opinion is that traditional councils are not elected bodies, but they are established in terms of Section 3 of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act. And according to the Constitutional Court judgment, the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, the court actually came clear to indicate that all public power that is being exercised, it must be exercised according to the Constitution and the law. And thus we do not have many different systems that guide our system of law, but the Constitution is the supreme law of the country, is the main primary guiding law, and that's how we should follow the system. And then having said that, it is a current policy of government that the traditional leadership currently plays an advisory role to the programs of government, and that is in terms of the traditional leadership policy that was issued out in 2003, and which has also been implemented and taken through to the legislation that I've mentioned, like the intergovernmental traditional, the traditional leadership government framework act. And therefore, in conclusion to that submission, we are saying the committee, as this is a policy decision which the committee is empowered to make, as well as a political decision. So it's up to the committee to decide how they take forth this matter, whether it's discussed and a political decision is made, as well as a policy decision, which then can be implemented and effective through legislation. Then the other proposal, which is linked with this one of changing local municipalities into traditional councils where it's a traditional community, is that they suggest that houses of traditional leaders should be regarded as departments that are under legislatures, which in other words, the National House of Traditional Leadership would be under Parliament as a department, and then the provincial houses would be under provincial legislatures. I think that's the gist of their suggestion. But looking at just understanding what the term department means, basically we are saying departments are established by the president through proclamations in terms of the Public Service Act. And hence there seems to be some bit of confusion in the suggestion where they say traditional councils should play a role as a as a local government structure somehow, alternatively traditional houses being departments under provincial legislatures. But then again, we said that is a policy decision to be decided upon by the powers that be. The third issue is the one dealing with traditional courts. The suggestion is basically that, as I said, traditional courts should actually be courts that are envisaged in Section 166E. If one looks at history of that, in the certification judgment from the Constitutional Court, the court was very clear to actually state that Section 166E is very open and wide. And all that it says is that a court can be any court as long as an act of parliament declares it so. And currently, with the parliamentary systems in place, there is a bill that is before parliament, the traditional courts bill. And our opinion basically states that until there is an act of parliament that sets out what are the structures, functions, and how traditional courts should operate, and one would not get to the details of the provision or content of the traditional courts bill as to whether it does speak to that issue or it does not. Because for now, currently, what we understand is that traditional courts are in existence, but they are in existence in terms of customary law as well as the Black Administration Act, which some of its provisions have been repealed, but the ones that specifically speak to traditional courts have been left in the statute books so that they do not leave the vacuum of not giving authority to the traditional courts. And that's a very old act. It's a 1927 act which was clearly enacted during the previous regime. So there is no required instance that really an amendment to Section 166 in order to accommodate traditional courts should be made, because it is already clear and the courts have confirmed its interpretation that actually 166E could be very encompassing to traditional courts being formed as part of the courts, as long as there is an act of parliament. And then that takes me to the last issue which they've raised, where they suggest that traditional councils in traditional communities, again, should actually be consulted by the Electoral Commission before elections take place. I also submit on this one, if you look through my opinion, that all Chapter 9 institutions are actually set out in the Constitution clearly with their mandates and obligations. But it also says national legislation will then thresh out the details of the functions and everything else that the Constitution has just given a skeleton to. Thus, the suggestion itself, the Electoral Commission must, in consultation with traditional councils, deal with the elections in traditional communities. So what we are basically saying is that the Constitution is not so outrightly indicating this obligation that they want here for purposes of traditional communities only. The Constitution, all that it says, and in fact read consistently with the legislation, which is the Electoral Act as well as the Electoral Commission Act, it does provide room for consultation with the spheres that the Electoral Commission will be preparing and managing elections for. But that is not made mandatory, either from the Constitution or from the Electoral Acts themselves. But from the provisions that are quoted there, it is actually clear that there is room for consultation, but it is not a must and an in consultation. is consultation that works in order to promote relations, and practically that's what the Electoral Commission has actually done through the structures that they have in place, and it is working well, which the same can be done as well if it's not already practically done within the traditional communities. And hence our suggestion or advice to the committee is that there is no need for an amendment to Section 190 of the Constitution, but perhaps just these institutions to be alerted that there seems to be a complaint and maybe traditional communities are not attended in the same manner as with the other structures or spheres of government when it comes to election time. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, just to basically sum up the opinion on the IFP submission. The submission raises quite a number of substantial issues. But if one interrogates the submissions, it is apparent that the issues that are raised are not necessarily related to constitutional provision, that there are pieces of legislation that the institution, Parliament, has enacted, giving effect to constitutional provisions, that some of these issues that the IFP is raising can be adequately addressed by perhaps referring these issues to the relevant committees of Parliament, that they can take those proposals to the relevant portfolios that administers or oversees the implementation of those pieces of legislation to see to it whether or not these issues could be taken forward. That is basically, in short, the proposal we're making to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, members. I will then be taking the committee through Constitutional Review Committee CR 1213, which is a submission by the Commission for Gender Equality. The Commission for Gender Equality is making the submission in terms of their of the CGE Act, which allows them to make certain recommendations and submissions to Parliament or Parliamentary Committee. The CGE makes two specific recommendations, and I'll deal with them individually. The first one is a proposed amendment or inclusion in Section 9(3) of the Constitution, which basically deals with the listed grounds of discrimination in the Constitution. Basically, they suggest that disability should be included as one of the listed grounds on which the state may not discriminate. It observes, and this is from their submission, that Section 3 does not include the category of disabled who are a vulnerable group and face considerable discrimination. But if the members read Section 9(3), specifically lists disability there. So I don't think the committee would need to consider that specific submission any further because it's already one of the listed grounds against which the state may not discriminate. And also, even if that listed ground wasn't there, it says, and any other ground. So one could then interpret that in that specific clause as well. The next submission made by the CGE is the proposed the proposed review of Section 132 of the Constitution, which deals with the power of the of a premier of a province to appoint his or her members of executive councils or MECs. They submit that this needs to be reviewed in order to ensure compliance with gender equity targets when appointments are made, and they list a specific example of Western Cape, where the Premier appointed a specific amount of or just men to her cabinet. They submit that such an approach is envisaged in terms of Section 9 of the Constitution, since there are no checks and balances created in Section 132. And 132 is quite express. It says that the Premier may appoint, dismiss, and assign functions and powers of those members of executive councils. From the, in reading their submission, I wasn't clear which specific gender equity targets they were, the CGE was referring to, and whether these targets are legally binding on premiers. To my knowledge, I don't know of any specific gender equity targets that are binding, besides the policy decisions made by each individual political party, like the 50-50 campaign. Section 125 of the Constitution provides that the executive authority of a province is vested in the premier of that province, and he or she exercises her executive authority when he or she appoints his or her cabinet. Any executive action, and this is reiterated in various court, constitutional court case judgments, that says that any executive authority or any executive action must be in line with the spirit and purpose of the Constitution. And in exercising that executive action, a premier is bound only by the Constitution. Section 1 of the Constitution furthermore provides that as a democratic state of Africa is founded on principles of the supremacy of the Constitution and rule of law. This is confirmed in Section 2 of the Constitution. Therefore, any conduct of a premier and indeed even the president has to be measured against these constitutional standards of transparency, openness, fairness. A premier's action in appointing members of the Executive Council is therefore only fettered by the constitutional principles that I have mentioned and those ones enumerated in Section 1 of the Constitution and then confirmed in Section 2. I then go further and say that if any person or institution or body is of the opinion that these constitutional standards are not being adhered to, it is open to that said person, institution, or body to follow the available legal avenues to challenge that specific appointment. I then recommend that the Constitutional Review Committee not consider the submission for the purposes of an amendment to the a constitutional provision. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I am dealing with CR 1214. It is an opinion, or it was a submission by a Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Communities, proposing an amendment to Section 6.1 of the Constitution dealing with languages. The Commission itself is a Chapter 9 institution, and they, in terms of their constitutional mandate, they are established to promote respect for the rights of cultural, religious, and linguistic communities. Their submission follows a fact-finding mission based on the information provided, a long-standing complaint lodged by the, I apologize for my pronunciation, Balu Vidu community. Balu Vidu community, thank you, to the Commission on behalf of the, and I might need assistance with this as well, Kelu Vedu speaking community, based on the non-recognition of the Kelu Vedu as an official language and the teaching of the Pedi as a first language to the Balu Vedu learners. So the Commission's submission is that the Kelu Vedu as an official language should be included in 6.1. Advocate Gordon has, in a previous submission, highlighted some of the language rights and issues and legislation. I would just like to supplement that by stating that the Constitutional Court has acknowledged that language is a sensitive issue in South Africa. And when in the certification case they dealt with language, they dealt very carefully with it in saying that the focus of Section 6 was the protection of linguistic diversity and not the status of any particular language or languages. So the court left that responsibility to choose the official languages to the Constitutional Assembly, and that now has by implication that weighty responsibility has now been passed on to Parliament, and due to the mandate of the committee, then it unfortunately falls here to determine whether a language or it should be reported that a language should be included or not. What is perhaps of interest here is Section 6 deals with status, but one must also keep in mind that the Bill of Rights have certain individual language rights. So you have language rights linked to education, you have language rights linked to your cultural heritage and your choice of how you your cultural practices. What's interesting here is that the complaint is linked to the fact that this community's children are being taught in a different language. And if one looks at the Bill of Rights and the Education Rights, Section 29, it says everyone has the right to receive education in the official language or languages of their choice. So it is a weighted decision that falls in this committee to recommend to Parliament whether or not to include such an amendment for this community so that their children can receive an education in an official language of their choice. Otherwise, if the committee feels from a policy basis, because I must advise this is not a legal issue, it's policy, that this language perhaps should be granted at least constitutional development status, Section 6.5 does allow for the Pan-South African Language Board to be established, and that has been done, but to promote and create conditions for the development and use of all official languages, and then they say the Khoi, the Nama, and San languages and sign language. A development option could then also be to include this language for among 5A Roman numeral 2 with Khoi, Nama, and San languages there, but that ultimately remains a policy decision for the committee to back chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will address the submission CR12-15. The submission is made by a private person. I will simply refer to the surname, Minka Binde, for ease of reference. Minka Binde addresses two issues in the submission. The first one is a proposed amendment to Section 139, Sub 1 of the Constitution, and including the concept Ubuntu into Section 10 of the Constitution. I will first look at the proposed amendment to Section 139, Sub 1. Section 139, Sub 1 deals with intervention in the affairs of municipalities. It is the discretion given to a province under certain circumstances to intervene in their affairs. When you analyze Ntobinde's proposal, it seems to be more in the nature of criticism against the executive of the relevant provinces for not intervening, rather than addressing a lacuna in the Constitution. The Constitution has sufficient measures to ensure that municipalities perform, and if municipalities fail to perform, for provincial and government, national government to interfere. We are all aware that the government of South Africa is set up in three spheres, distinctive, interdependent, interrelated, and that cooperative government and intergovernmental principles are applicable. With this in mind, if we have a look at sections within the Constitution that allows for intervention, we'll see that it is quite extensive. Section 157, sub 7, gives the legislative as well as the executive authority to national and provincial governments and to see to the effective performance of municipalities' executive functions. Section 139.1 provides for the provincial executive to intervene in the affairs of a municipality under certain circumstances. Now, if there's a concern that the provincial executive is not doing their job, then Section 133 indicates that the executive council of a province are collectively and individually, the members, sorry, are collectively and individually accountable to the legislature of that province. So the legislature of that province should simply help hold them accountable for not intervening. Furthermore, the national executive can intervene in the affairs of a province in terms of Section 100. And then Section 139 further in subsections 4 and 5 actually provides for an obligation to intervene in certain circumstances. So there's quite a number of measures that can be taken to ensure the municipalities perform. It's already provided for in the Constitution. Another aspect that the committee must consider is that currently most of these
intervention competencies are discretionary in nature. If you just have an obligation, as Mr. proposes, you change the ball game a little bit, because in that instance, if it's not done, a court cannot consider constraints such as capacity, finance, where a province or national government does not intervene. Whereas if there's a discretion, there are a number of factors that come into play. As I've said, there are sufficient sections that already deal with what to do when the discretion is not exercised and it should be exercised. However, it remains a policy decision. It will not address a lacuna in the Constitution. The Constitution does make provision, but there is nothing that would prevent the Constitution from making more provision in this regard. The second aspect that Ngabendi addresses is Ubuntu. And to make this part of the right to human dignity, which is set out in Section 10 of the Constitution. When I looked at this, I did a little bit of research on Ubuntu, and I've actually found two articles. Extracts are attached to the opinion, and they are available from the Parliamentary Library, which I found extremely interesting. Ubuntu is something that is so entrenched in our law already that it is an integral part. Our courts, for instance, indicate that our constitution is suffused by Ubuntu. I've referred you to three cases, Makwanyani, Port Elizabeth Municipality, and Dikoko. The references are, in my opinion, in footnotes 11, 12, and 13, where the courts every time indicate that it permeates the Constitution generally. It suffuses the whole constitutional order. It is intrinsic to and constitutive of our constitutional culture. It feeds pervasively into and enriches the fundamental rights enshrined in the Constitution. So our courts are saying our Constitution is Ubuntu. Also academics, and that is where the articles come in, have looked at Ubuntu, and some of the academics say that there's no need to look for African characteristics in the Bill of Rights, for the Bill of Rights reflects universal values and ideals of which African values form an integral part. All values are essentially the same, even though they might be expressed in a different idiom. Ubuntu, furthermore, is not just in our constitution. Our courts have applied Ubuntu in criminal law, administrative law, law of property, contract law, family law. So it is something that is permeating our legal system, and it's starting to form, in fact, the spill around which our law is turning. So whether to include Ubuntu in Section 10 or not is, however, a policy decision. It is something, again, as I said before, with the other opinion, it is not something that will be new. It does not address a lacuna, but it is a policy decision whether to address it or not. Something, however, should the committee decide that Ubuntu must specifically be by name included in our constitution, is something that academia warns about, and that is the broad meaning of Ubuntu, and the fact that it is not only dignity, but all the values. It is interaction in the community. It is such a concept that if a decision is taken to intervene, that we must be very careful not to limit it, because once it's written down, you start having a restriction around it, or some interpreted. It must be a definition to this. So, like just maybe to summarize, again, it is a policy decision. But if decided to do so, please just be careful how to word it. Thank you.
Thank you, members. I am now reading my last one. It's CR 1216. And it is based on a submission by Mr. Moses Mashile from the Mpumalanga provincial government. And the submission is relating to the role and functions of traditional leaders. It was a bit difficult to respond to Mashile's submission because he initially gave an email sent an email with 5 points of indicating sections or issues that he would like the committee to consider when reviewing for amendments to the Constitution, with a qualification that he will elaborate on Monday, 4 June 2012. That elaboration was not received, so I had to be very creative in trying to find out what Mr. Mashile wants the committee to do where he did not indicate a chapter or a section. So a lot of this is assuming from a general perspective. He made a general statement. I responded in general accordingly. The first issue that Mr. Mashile specifically highlighted was sections 42 and 60 of the Constitution. He requested that the committee consider amending the Constitution to allow the inclusion of the traditional leaders or the House of National House of Traditional Leaders within the National Council of Provinces, thereby abolishing the National House of Traditional Leaders. I think I'm just quickly going to go through all five. And then supplementary to that, he highlighted section 212 and requested that that be amended to elaborate on the functions and duties of traditional leaders, including the enforcement of the code of conduct, dispute resolution, withdrawal, etc. He went on to look at section 76 of the Constitution, which deals with bills and the processing of bills, and then says that all section 76 bills should be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders. That point actually contradicts the fact that the National House of Traditional Leaders should be abolished and form part of the NCOP. So my confusion set in not having his background material to elaborate on that statement. And then he made two broad statements without linking it to any section of the Constitution, saying that the duties of the chairpersons of the National House and provincial houses of traditional leaders should be clarified and equated to that of the Speaker of the National Assembly and the chairperson of the NCOP, or where relevant, the speakers of the provincial legislatures. And then he also said that members of the national and the provincial houses of traditional leaders should be equated to members of the national and provincial legislatures. I assume with the latter he meant status-wise, benefit-wise, and so forth. With regard to that equation, that's something that can be dealt with in legislation and is when it comes to benefits of public office bearers, payment status, all of that, it is regulated. And in fact, in the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act, the status of traditional leaders is also set out in there. Same with the code, it is in the Act already. So without the background of whether he wants the code and all the status and benefit requirements to actually be now in the Constitution and taken out of the Act, I think it's sufficient to say that there's already legislation dealing with that, that allows scope, if it should be amended, that the status should be equated, that should be done through legislation. To get back to his request that the National House of Traditional Leaders should be abolished and form part of the NCOP, I think it is important to highlight that in terms of Section 42 of the Constitution, when one looks at the composition of Parliament, and specifically why we have the National Council of Provinces, it says the National Council of Provinces is there mainly to look at the effect of issues on the provinces and to do this through participation. And one must also then keep in mind the elections system that we as a government actually have now. We work through electoral system where people are democratically elected and then nominated from provincial legislators to serve in the NCOP, while with the traditional leaders, National House of Traditional Leaders, that works through a nomination system that the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act allows for. Interestingly enough, when democratically elected representatives in the NCOP will then look at interests of the provinces, and also then they are there as elected officials of the people. In Section 16 of the Act dealing with traditional leaders, it specifically says in 16.2, a House of Traditional Leaders and its resources may not be used to promote or prejudice the interests of any political party. Elections are political. People choose their political representatives to promote their interests in Parliament, whether provincial or legislature, or in the national legislature. So they're to align that, when abolishing the House of Traditional Leaders, the whole system of parliament should, and then also the electoral system will ultimately have to be amended, because somehow you'll have to align the fact that there are now representatives who aren't there as a political representatives of the people, and they're not allowed to promote political interests, and on the other hand, their colleagues sitting there from this, from a similar province must do so. So when it comes to mandate and votes, all of that will have to be reviewed. Ultimately, a structure of a parliament is a policy decision. It can be amended, but it will be a big, it will be a whole system change. It's not just something small. And as I said, absent his background or arguments for that, I am, yeah, I don't know why he is saying that. Then section 212, that he requires the role of traditional leaders to be looked at. The Constitutional Court, in dealing with the certification of the Constitution, specifically looked at the relevant sections and then said it cannot, the Constitutional Assembly cannot be constitutionally faulted for leaving the complicated and varied and ever-developing specifics of how leadership, traditional leadership, should function in the wider democratic society to future social evolution and legislative deliberation. So once again, the Constitutional Court passed the buck to Parliament to decide on a policy basis how the role, status, and functioning of traditional leaders in terms of Section 212 should be regulated. So ultimately, that again is unfortunately not a legal question, unfortunately for me. I don't find that way to present, but a policy decision for Parliament today, whether that, as there is social evolution that requires Section 212 to be reviewed. As I mentioned with Section 76 and the processing of bills affecting provinces, where Mr. Mashila, now I'm assuming he is acting from the assumption that if his first amendment is not, or first proposed amendment does not go through, he and the National House of Traditional Leaders says he would like all 76 bills to be officially referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders. I think there one must focus on the fact that the Act, the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act, in Section 18 of that Act, actually allows not just for Section 76 bills, but for any parliamentary bill that pertains to customary law and customs of traditional communities to be referred to that House already. Again, absent his reasoning for it, I think there's already legislation dealing with that wider than his proposed amendment, because if there is a 76 that is relevant from a customary law perspective, that would have to be referred to the House, but also similarly anything else. So it's wider than 76. I can't see why he would like to limit it to 76 if that is his intention. And as I said, his third request for amendment actually contradicts on the paper his first one, but ultimately again that remains a policy decision for the committee to take whether to restrict such referrals to 76 bills only. Thank you. Honourable Minister, thank you.
Yes,
thank you. I'm also going on to my last presentation, which comes from the Centre for Constitutional Rights, which is a unit under the FW de Klerk Foundation. It was a very long submission from Advocate Kruger, but he calls it concise submission. It basically suggests changes or omission of Section 47(3)(c) of the Constitution. And Section 47(3)(c) of the Constitution is basically one of the sections which indicate how does membership to the NAACC. He states in summary that this section comes short of what we envisaged as a participatory democracy, in that it limits accountability, responsiveness, and openness, which are the constitutional values for our democracy. It also limits the freedom of individual members of the National Assembly to follow the dictates of personal conscience and moral conviction. It prevents the National Assembly from being the envisaged effective nation's committee of grievances or a congress of opinions. It renders members of the National Assembly accountable to their party's first rather than to the voters who theoretically elected them. He also says it reduces openness when members of parliament and the national executive do not feel obliged to explain their actions or inactions or decisions to voters. and therefore it diminishes the right to freedom of association for the members of the National Assembly. We then looked at some of the constitutional relevant sections, which if you look at paragraph 7 of my opinion, it says that in section 42, 3 and 4, Parliament is a forum for debate on important issues. And then section 55.2 and 92.2, Parliament must hold the executive organs of state in the national sphere of government accountable and exercise an oversight function of the exercise of national authority. Thus, these specific sections of the Constitution are the ones that Advocate Kruger is actually substantiating some of the contentions that he's raising with regards to section 47.3c. And thus, he basically asked that the electoral system, together with section 47.3c, should be reconsidered, and that is what his proposal is basically all about. Now, as my colleagues have indicated with the court's jurisprudence, that we have made a choice for the electoral system, which is now prescribed in terms of national legislation, and that system actually is the one promoting proportional representation instead of constituency system. As he argues, there are two notions that come out, which is the notion that members, once elected, they have a free mandate to exercise whatever the powers that they are given, and there's also an imperative mandate. So these two mandates are distinct in one another, in that, as Advocate Kruger argues, one promotes individual, that the free mandate notion means that elected representatives are not bound by outside directives, but are guided by their own conscience to act in the national interest. And that is the mandate that Advocate Kruger seems to be advancing, rather than the imperative mandate, which means that elected representatives are bound by the orders of the party under the banner which they were elected. So as I've indicated, that basically the courts have also indicated that the issue of an electoral system is a matter of choice as well as a matter of political decision. Therefore, it is a question that the parliament or the committee may look at, decide whether it is about time that we reconsider change into the existing electoral system, or practically the system that is in place is working. It's a decision that must be made. And therefore, in line with the court jurisprudence and our advice, we are actually saying that this is a political dream and a policy development that may be decided either by Parliament or by the executive. And we are also of the view that the electoral system, as well as section 47.3c of the Constitution, is a policy consideration, and thus, at the moment, until that decision is made, there is really not much that can be done to the Constitution. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, as officials working for the People's Parliament, we recognize the importance of the voices of the people. It is in that understanding and spirit that we invested time and resources to research and prepare these opinions for consideration by a committee. You will notice that we did not seek to assume your responsibilities, but only focused on the legal issues, on the submissions. We have concluded our business, and we hereby submit our opinions to the committee. I thank you, sir.
Thank you, Kukit Navana. Honourable members, we will deal with the submissions in our next meeting. I think members will familiarize themselves with all the submissions. As you are aware, there are a couple that perhaps they need committee deliberations. However, if there's any clarity-seeking questions, we won't hesitate to call you again to come and clarify us on some of the issues. Is there anything other members would like to say? Anything?
from members other room.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, you know, there's other submissions that is very straightforward that the legal team have proposed. Why are we not dealing with that? They have clearly said we must not consider. Now, if the committee decides we must deal with it in the next meeting, it's also fine. But you see, it's a lot of things here, and we can dispatch of some of this.
I agree with Honourable Prum that you can dispatch with some of those, but the unfortunate point is that it don't correct. If with the quorum, would have dealt with them with those that don't need actually our deliberations. Our
Yes, I think I agree with that. I have nothing to add to that. But from our side, we also need to thank the legal team for all the time and energy that they put into this whole process. It doesn't take only a few minutes to write legal opinions like these, even though some of the issues are quite clear. But so from our side, I think let's thank them and say thank you very much for the energy that you put into this whole process and wisdom.
Okay, thanks, Honourable Members. Honourable Bloom?
Yeah, no, I also want to add that thing. I forgot, and I wanted to start with that, but now he was taking my mind away. But I want also to really appreciate the hard work. And you must not only do it for the committee, but also for me as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Members, and thank you from our legal team. And thanks very much for all your submissions and the time and you invested in looking into this and your opinions. Definitely, if we come across any issue that we still need clarity on, we want the state to come in and knock on your door. And thanks a lot, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Between 8 and 6 years. No, this is a bottle of wood.